I decided to like start that process and go into the beeswax and dye. And the minute I started that, painting wise, all the screen print and the oil paint, the, all that stuff just like kind of dissipated. And I discovered and reinvented this technique into my own process.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the artist Shivago Duncan. Hi, Shivago.
Hi. Hello.
Shivago, maybe we start with where you come from.
Well, my mother is Syrian, born in Damascus. My father is Danish, born in Copenhagen to a American Scottish father. I was born in Terre Haute, Indiana, but never lived there, and grew up between Saudi Arabia, France, Malta, England, all over the States, and we moved a lot.
Because they were diplomats?
No, my father worked in tourism.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a Navy guy, and so he moved a lot. And what I learned in my own experience from moving a lot is once you start to like adapt to this nomadic lifestyle, it's very difficult to break from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my father spoke a lot of languages. I kind of adopted that brain set with the ability to learn languages very fast and the just adaptability to different cultures and places. And so, you know, people ask me where I'm from and it's always a very complicated answer.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, mm-hmm. I feel at home pretty much everywhere.
And you stick to that still, right? You spend time in Berlin, now you're currently in Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, I've been just in this constant yearning to find home. And then I realized that home doesn't really, like, there's not really a place for home. Home is always in between certain places.
Mm-hmm.
I've been now in Mexico for 7 years, and Mexico feels very much like home.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a place where I will have a base. It also feels home to come back to Berlin, because I was in Berlin for 9 years. You know, Berlin was a very big breaking moment of the cycle of leaving for
mm-hmm,
me.
Mm-hmm.
So I really pushed that boundary.
And how did you get in touch with art? Was there like any role model in your upbringing?
No, I don't come at all from an art family. From very, very small, from very young, I started to draw. Society was always a difficult place for me to like exist, you know, coming from a very Middle Eastern mother. My emotional state wasn't always like allowed to be. I felt when I was a kid that, you know, everybody was just constantly stopping me from doing what I desired to do. And so I found absolute freedom in drawing. And when I was 4, I think my, you know, applause moment, we all like become what we are because there's a moment in our childhood where like we get applauded by the elders. And when I was 4, my mother saw a drawing that I made of a giraffe from my favorite cartoon, and then sent it to Highlight magazine when we lived at the time in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And then that magazine published it, and I was like one of the youngest, you know, kids to be published in this magazine. And I just remember it came out when I was 5, and I remember like seeing my drawing there amongst, you know, drawings from like 15-year-olds and 12-year-olds, and I just like, I was like, oh, this astronaut drawing has a hand that's out of proportion to the body. And I just remember being very critical about all of the drawings in there. However, I never knew that there was an actual possibility of being an artist until I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Because we moved every 2 years, and, you know, pre-internet, I had no connection. Like, before we had a connection to popular culture, we were gone. And
yeah.
So I would like being in another city, another state, another country. And it was like to start all over again. And when I was a kid, all of my connection to art was like the Louvre, because I grew up in France for quite a bit. And all of these, like the National Museum in Washington, D.C. And so for me, artists were like dinosaurs that were extinct. you know.
So you were, when looking at art, you were more looking at old masters than at contemporary art.
Yeah, I was looking at old masters all, like, as a kid. And then I went to my first like contemporary art show in my early 20s, you know.
Where was this?
I'd been studying anthropology, communications, and philosophy in the States. And it's a bit of a stretch, but I was 20 or 21, and we had, I'd finished high school in Malta, as my father had a job out there. And I was in a painting class, and my teacher, it was like a baccalaureate system school, but it was, you know, it was a 2-year baccalaureate system. And my art teacher was like obsessed with me. She's like, you're a painter, you need to paint. I'll help you do your baccalaureate system in 1 year instead of two. And then it was like the first thing of like, oh, what is it to be an art, like an artist, a painter? And I just know that I enjoyed it. And so when my father was like, you know, he didn't have an education. He worked his way like in hotels from a very young age. And then, you know, so for him, it was like, you need to get an education. And we were talking about, you know, universities and stuff. And he's like, what do you want to study? And I said, oh, I really like art. And he was said to me like over my dead body, like literally. So I was like, okay.
Like not happening.
Yeah. And so I went and studied these other things. However, in my senior year, right after my senior year, during my senior year in high school, my father got very ill. And then we went to, you know, he got treatment in the United States, came back and I graduated and I stayed a year at home to like help take care of him. And he passed away. Then I went to university and I studied anthropology, communications, philosophy. And I was just kind of finding my way in university. And I was driving, I was going to a university and a community college at the same time to get credits. And I was driving to the community college. I was like 21. And I'm driving to this college and I stopped my car on the way. It was like the beginning of the year. And I stopped my car and I was like, okay, like I'm going to this university. I'm going to study something that I do not like with a teacher I do not like in a school that I don't like. And I'm paying to do this. I'm paying money to do something that I don't enjoy.
Yeah.
And so I just...
And the pressure from the father was sort of...
Yeah, the pressure...
Still there, but not...
Yeah, it was there. And not executed. He had just died. Yeah, yeah. You know? And so I was like, I'm not doing this. So I turned my car around. I went home and I had this, you know, existential moment. And my brother at the time was like trying to follow in my father's footpaths in London. And he was like doing a hotel management course. And I went to go visit him. I'd like had a job and I'd saved some money and, you know, went to go visit my brother. And him, like a person who's like completely out of the arts, totally, was like, oh, you have to come and see this show. And so he took me to see like the Saatchi show, and Saatchi had like re-shown the Sensations exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked into the space, like, you know, greeted by the Hearst split cow and then Sarah Lucas and the Chapman brothers and, you know, and I was just like, this is what I do. Like I've all my life, like even when I was studying anthropology and philosophy, like I was making oil paintings at home. Like I was doing this on my free time. Stealing oil colors from the art shop because I couldn't afford to pay for them. I'd go and buy like a pencil and eraser and like, you know, just nick some oil paints. And basically, yeah, so I went to see the show and I was just like, okay, I'm going to study art in London. And I went back to DC at the time. And I was just like, I'm selling all my stuff. I applied to Central St. Martin's. I got accepted into the foundation program, got rid of all my affairs and just went to London to study.
And when do you think you found sort of your voice and language? Was it already then?
I think I had found my voice and language very young. My work is very intuitive and I feel that like we get subconsciously like infiltrated with what we see and what we were growing up with. And I had a specific language that like existed inside of me. And then, you know, certain things happened in my childhood, especially like I have a very funny story, which, you know, I went to art school, and when I was in art school, everybody was like, oh, you paint like Jean-Michel Basquiat, you paint like Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I had no idea like who this was. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't, it was completely out of my realm. And then one night, one of my good friends was like hosting a movie night, and he was showing Julian Schnabel's like Basquiat movie. And we all went to watch it, and I was like, oh wow, this is like pretty cool. Like, you know, I like the story, the paintings were cool. And so I went home that night and I Googled Jean-Michel Basquiat, and I saw this face, you know, him like smiling with his hair and like the chipped tooth, and it just like, it triggered a memory. Mm-hmm. And I remember things from when I'm two. Like I have a really, like a movie-like memory where I see these scenes, and I remember something that happened when I was about three. And I just remember we were visiting New York with my mother and my aunt, and we were walking, it was like 1983, 84, and we were walking down this alleyway, and this, you know, African-American man arrived, and he was saying something to them, and they like panicked, thought he was trying to rob them, being the, you know, Syrian women that they are. And they literally, they went and they left me there. And I remember seeing this man's face, and he smiled at me, and he just had like, he was glowing, like he was like an angel. And I remember smiling back, and I remember very clearly, like on the floor, he had these little paintings. And when I saw this image of Jean-Michel on Google at the time, or was Yahoo, whatever I was searching with, it struck this memory. And then I started to research him, and I'm like, 83, 84, he was like already a superstar, and it didn't make any sense. And so I was like, is this a real memory? Is it not? And, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this went on, and I graduated. I was invited to Berlin for a show. And when I got to Berlin, like a friend introduced me to one of her friends who was visiting from LA, a like movie producer, and he was in town, came to do a studio visit, loved the work. It was, you know, too big for him to take home with him, but he was like, hey, I'm like organizing a party tonight at Cafe Burger, you should come. And I was like, oh, sure, whatever. And it turned out it was like a party for Madonna for the Berlinale, and she was like, she had directed a movie. And so I ended up at this party.
Cafe Burger was Torstrasse, right?
Yeah, yeah, Cafe Burger was Torstrasse, yeah. Yeah. And so I'm at Cafe Burger, and I'm the first one there because I didn't go to the movie, I was painting. And like Madonna arrives with her crew, and I'm just kind of hanging around, like having drinks or whatever. And at some point I cross her, and she looks at me, she's like, hey, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Zhivago. She's like, where are you from? I'm like, well, I was born in Indiana. She's like, what the fuck are you doing here? I'm like, well, I'm a painter. And she's like, oh, I can see your hands are filthy. And we talk and talk and talk and talk. And she's very nice. And I say, hey, I actually have a question for you, because you dated like Jean-Michel, like, and I have this memory. And I explain to her the story, and she's like, that's totally Basquiat, that's totally Jean, because like, when he was making all this money, like he'd make like hundreds of thousands of dollars and then go to bars and give everyone in the bar like $100 and then pay everyone's bill, spend all of his cash. And then he would like, you know, sell these little postcards on the street to make some little cash to, you know, have a bite and like get some heroin. And so in a way, this like somehow infiltrated me as a kid, you know, and my work went in this direction. And then when I, you know, went in my 20s, and it was like quite wild. Like I had a lot of energy. I still have a lot of energy. And so in art school, like there wasn't enough surface for me to paint on. You know, like I would like sell a small painting and buy paints with all the money that I make and like finish them in a week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe like two paintings out of 10 were like good. The rest was like rubbish.
So, and when you came to Berlin, you what type of show was it you came for?
When I was in art school, I became friends with an exchange student from Berlin, from Weissensee.
Mm-hmm.
And his friends were organizing a fair in Cologne called like Tees Art Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited to Cologne to do a piece. A collector of mine funded my trip, and I made this like crazy machine that threw dinner plates, like hand-painted dinner plates across the room, and they smashed in a gong that I built. And I did this installation, and we went and did that. And then the organizers, Aiko Sabella and Edmund Pieper,
mm-hmm.
at the time, they were also doing a show here called Kunstsalon
mm-hmm.
during the art forum time.
Yeah.
And so they invited me after graduation. They gave me a spot in the what's now the Uferhallen.
Yeah.
It used to be like the BVG, like workshops.
And so you just stayed.
I did that. And I did this installation for there, this like painting, neon, like ink installation. And then I was like invited for my first show. And then like the next one and the next. And then, you know, things just started to roll from there.
So when we look at your work, there's, I would say, sort of two lines. One is the paintings and works on paper, which are very sort of in pastel colors, cloudy, have like sort of pop art or comic references from more wider gesture into total detail. And then you do these sculptures, installations, like the kinetic one you just described.
Yeah.
Train wrecks circulating and so on. And but one very important element in your practice is beeswax. Maybe you can take us on that process, how that came together and how you work on the canvas and what type of canvas too.
So over the last 6 years, and I had been contemplating it for the last decade. So my last few years in Berlin, when I was painting, you know, because my work had gone also into, you know, quite figurative, like oil painting, and Berlin allowed me to like, you know, really focus in and like control the chaos of my work on like multiple different project bases. And along the course of that, I was thinking about this practice, which is, it's called like batik, that's beeswax dyeing technique. And it's a way of painting or a way of like coloring surface that exists all over the world. Like it's existed everywhere in some form of like beeswax and dye. It's a kind of like the bow and arrow. It doesn't really have like an origin. It's very prominent in Indonesia and Africa, India, like today. And I learned that technique in Malta when I was like 16 or 17 in high school. And then I was thinking about it for years. I'm like, oh, I want to like do that, but on really large surfaces as a layer to my paintings. And so when I left Berlin and I arrived to Mexico, I had a year gap before my next show. And so I decided to like start that process and go into the beeswax and dye. And the minute I started that, I just, everything else, just like painting wise, all the screen print and the oil paint, all that stuff just like kind of dissipated. And I discovered and reinvented this technique into my own process, you know, following a creation myth that I'd been, you know, thinking about, like adding all of the creation myths that exist together and so on and so forth, and following this suit and realizing that, you know, everything follows like the evolution of consciousness itself. And so, you know, how did like empathy evolve through human mythology and through time, type of thing. And then with the beeswax, I just started gravitating to these very natural processes, and bees I've always been fascinated by bees. Like a bee saved my life on a motorcycle years ago, and they exist.
How?
It's a really crazy story. So I used to ride motorcycles, and My first bike that I got was a very fast Yamaha in a summertime. Like I had sold a painting and bought this Yamaha, and I was riding it in San Jose, California for some months with a big like group of bikers. And I was a new guy in the group. We used to go past these like mountains and race in these like mountain hills. And I was always last because I didn't know the course. And so I'd wake up every morning at 7 and I'd go and like learn it until I got really good at it. And one morning I woke up and I was kind of feeling like not so hot. And I was riding, and before you get past these valleys where there's no more police and no more, you know, where we start to go fast, there's like 7 or 8 red lights, and every light I got to turned red as I arrived to it. And I was like, maybe I shouldn't ride this for some reason. And then I kept going. I'm like, fuck it, I'm gonna do it. And I kept going and going and going. And then finally, I got past the red lights. Every single one of them turned red as I got to it. And then I passed the valley, and this is where we could go fast. And I just started, I just hit the gas, and I was flying. I was doing about, you know, 240 kilometers an hour. And I was fully suited. So I had like, you know, leathers and a jacket, and I had, you know, maybe 3 centimeters of skin, which were my neck. And in those 3 centimeters, I got stung by a bee, like going that speed. I just hit a bee and it like stung me. So I like pulled over, I was quite shaky, and I pulled the stinger out and I was like, okay, I need to slow down. So I decided to continue the route, but I would go, you know, 40 kilometers an hour. Mm-hmm. And I did, and I continued, and there was one very large turn off the edge of a cliff. You know, it's like a mountain going down, and there was this like 110 degree blind turn because it's coming around the mountain, which normally we would be flying and like, you know, touching our knees in that turn. And there was a rock slide. And so had I like been going fast, I would have fallen off the mountain.
But did that, you more think in a higher transcendental way, or that suddenly you came back to beeswax and
reconnect to the dots? Well, it's just one of those dots, you know?
Yeah.
Like I guess through like my memory and through just, you know, the ability of deep meditation and like existence, and I kind of always piece the dots together, you know? Like I kind of follow the path that like life chooses, that life like, you know, life gives me clues.
Mm-hmm.
To head in certain directions.
But also, I mean, sometimes in your paintings, there are these like smoke clouds, which
yeah.
come from a pipe, from a motorcycle or from a car or so.
Yeah, I mean, that could be a way of looking at it. There's actually, the way that I work, it's very much rooted in symbology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of the pieces, they are, you know, interconnectivity, and they're like networks that are representing sections of like the creation myth, you know,
But how did you come across that material itself? And maybe you can take us also on how, because it's almost, your studio is a bit almost like a laboratory. So you are cooking
yeah.
this beeswax on a certain temperature.
Yeah.
But how does the different colors come into the beeswax?
So I'm working with beeswax dye, pigment, and, you know, colored pencil or pastel, you know, for like initial drawings. So I heat the beeswax, and I found this perfect temperature of the beeswax to that it doesn't penetrate the canvas, so that it creates another dimension, like a three-dimensional line to the canvas. And where the lines are, these are all like walls. They're, you know, differentiations of space, and within that space I use the dye. So all of the paintings are made horizontally, and I dye the different sections, mixing my colors basically and naming my colors. So I have a very like complex rack of colors with all these very, you know, funny names that people think, but I do it in a way, like, again, using my memory, I create like what's called in German an Eselsbrücke. You know, this, what I do is I mix my colors and I put the first color down, and the first thing that comes to mind, the first image that I see in my head from that color becomes the name of the color. And so I will always remember what the mix is of the color. So I create these color lists, and, you know, fill in the sections with the color a lot of the times, like randomly, because I truly don't really believe in color. I think color is, you know, everything has all the colors in it all the time. So you can really mix any color together and it will turn out all right. You know, it'll turn out okay. So yeah, I fill in the spaces, the dye dries on the canvas, and then I will like go in with the wax again and create the next layer of wax, which is the next same color on each surface to deepen the color. And then with this way of working it, I'm actually working in a reverse, where as opposed to working from dark to light as an oil painting, I'm working from light to dark. And a lot of the times the initial sketch line of the drawing is actually the negative space. It's the canvas color. So it's a white canvas line.
And you made a lot of tests from a restoration point of view, that it's like because the beeswax connects to the canvas?
The beeswax connects to the canvas. It doesn't, like, the beeswax will not melt unless it's like 70 degrees Celsius, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times I remove the wax in certain areas. And then on the other hand, the wax is meant that over the course of, you know, 10 years, 20 years, it's meant to fall off the canvas. Mm-hmm. It still like doesn't. I mean, sometimes I'll like, you know, manipulate the canvas for it to become looser.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the idea of, in a sense, like a lighter, evolved version of the Joseph Beuys's Honigpumpe,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
where he pumped, you know, honey through a building to make it sweeter, to elevate. Was it 73 or 74?
Well, I think it was Documenta 5, I guess, but I'm not sure. How did you come across beeswax? Like, when did that come into the work?
Well, it's not like the original way of doing it in history is beeswax, and then it evolved into paraffin. But I just I don't know, I guess like...
No, but when did you come across it? Like, how did that...
Oh, when I was a kid. As a kid, I always had this obsession with candles and beeswax and fire and, you know...
And how does your installation work and your canvases connect? Because you have this big installation at the Paris Museum in Miami.
I would say that my oeuvre from like then till now has been a little bit like a Tarantino movie, mm-hmm. where, you know, you start the movie by watching the end, you know, and then like you get into like previous, and then you have this like back and forth. And so in the entirety, to like make it very short, right? So the work now that I'm doing is like a conversation about the birth of consciousness, the evolution of consciousness, and how does consciousness physically evolve through like the earth, through the earth's evolution, through humanity, through our consciousness, and how will it end up being like shifting over into the next stage, which I believe, which is what we call artificial intelligence. Then that's like the next phase of consciousness, where consciousness will understand the finite energy of the world and the sun, and then it will basically reduce everything to let all of this energy live out its natural course to attain the longest possible life. And within this giant story, there are like micro stories. And the installation stories, they came from a myth when I was working on these installations and these like paintings that are very like kind of graffiti-esque, collaged. And they came from a story of like the survivor, the sole survivor of the apocalypse, right? So there's like a technological apocalypse that happens, and there's like this one character named Richard Flashington, also known as Dick Flash, who like survives because he was like semi-frozen, but it still had a heartbeat, and like technology took over the world, eradicated most of like almost all humans, the animals started to take over, and then he was like he thawed out and suddenly was like semi-amnesic, doesn't know what's happening. And he roams the world, like building these crazy mantras out of what was like mundane society's objects, i.e. trains and planes and cars and so on and so forth. And he builds these mantras that are sustainable, that like hold as like, you know, apocalyptic attraction parks for remaining humans to follow his trail to like eventually rebuild a possible civilization. And so in the big story, that's is like a parenthesis that what I was working on when I was here. Really, essentially, when I was doing it, I had created that myth. And then I left and I started this other thing. And then I one day was in my studio and just realized, oh, holy, like, wow, this whole thing just like fits together in like a huge timeline.
Do you come back to it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the end, you know, we're one, like, we're one consciousness. We're one, we each have our like story. And if you really like look deep into yourself, you'll find that what you're doing now, it's not really different than what you did as a kid, you know?
And now you're visiting Berlin to also sort of put structure to your works. You left here when you left Berlin to go, I think first you went to LA, then to Mexico. How is it to come back? Because it's like a retrospective activity.
It's like kind of Christmassy, you know, like opening these crates and looking at works that I did. I mean, I have this one of my, the first painting that I did in Berlin from 2007 that was like straight after art school. And it was this very pivotal, like huge four panel painting that I actually never saw on a wall together because I never had a wall big enough to show it. And, you know, it was the first piece that I came coming from like this super like energetic chaos to this very structured, you know, German ethos that exists of like being organized and structured and taking time. And I got to see this painting and its pieces and just, yeah, a lot of the works are a lot better than I remember them to be, you know? And so I don't know, it's very interesting for me to see in a way like where I came from and also to see that like on first glance, it's very different to what I'm doing, but to see it, like there's so many links into, you know.
And will any, you're preparing a big solo exhibition at a museum in Monterrey?
Yeah, we're preparing a show that's supposed to be opening in November.
And is any of these work, is it an overview show or is it all new work?
It's half and half. I'm still in discussion with the curator, but we are taking some of these older works back. And my goal for the show is to create a narrative where you walk in again through like the previous work and you see this previous story that fits in to, you know, human archetype, the archetypes of the gods, the planets and all of these things that lie between all of these characters. And then you walk through almost like, you know, Inferno, like if we relate it to the Divine Comedy, which has always been a very important book in my life. You know, you kind of enter through Inferno, then you get through to Purgatory, and then you arrive to the main installation, which is the new work, which is almost like a heavenly aspect of like very large scale canvases and ceramics.
Oh yeah, that's actually a good point maybe for the, as a last point, the ceramics. That's something you started in Mexico, no?
I've done ceramics all of my, like since I'm very small as well. I learned it when I was like maybe 15. And then I had a period in Berlin where I did a lot of ceramics, but very small ones. And then in Mexico, I revisited like ceramic making after about 5 years, 6 years.
But you have a special, they have a very special place.
Yeah, I'm working with a really crazy ceramicist who makes literally the largest raku ceramics in the world, and or at least some of them. And it's a process of taking, like pushing the material to its furthest limit before it breaks.
Uh-huh.
And we lose works. So it's quite a risky performance, basically. And so there are two different, like I have the black ceramics, which are unglazed. And we take the original slip, because everything is very largely slip cast for the process. We have very specific minerals, and with slip cast, we reduce the possibility of bubbles. So we reduce breakage largely.
Mm-hmm.
And the original slip is white. It's like a, you know, very, very, very white when it when we bisque fire it. And so for the black pieces, we take them out when they're glowing hot at 1200 degrees Celsius. And then they come out red hot, and we lower these giant metal, you know, almost like steel terrariums over them,
mm-hmm.
that are lined with different sorts of paper and flammable material. And as we lower them, the heat of the ceramic ignites the paper and creates an internal fire in the case. And at the very end, we close the boxes entirely, creating a huge amount of pressure. And what happens is that the smoke with the pressure penetrates the clay,
mm-hmm.
and it makes it permanently black. Like the first like layer of the ceramic, so like 2 millimeters of this of the clay becomes stark black. Like
from the
smoke. Yeah. And it doesn't come off like
okay,
on your
so
hand.
That's a bit the connection also to the beeswax on the canvas, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, it's in mythology, beeswax, bees, they're super prominent. Like Zeus was raised on like honey and milk in the caves, like raised by bees. You know, in mostly all mythological stories, you know, humankind comes from clay or comes from the earth. And clay itself is a really fascinating material that's basically, it's dirt infected with a bacteria that changes the composition of the earth past like 600 degrees or 580 mm-hmm. degrees Celsius to make it like irreversibly hard. And so it's almost like clay is a living entity, you know, it's like a living earthly entity, which I mean, earth is alive. And so with this process, I'm challenging the earth in the clay itself to like not break. So it's almost like, you know, looking at the birth of our solar system, you know, it's we exist thanks to an explosion, you know.
Great, Zhivago. Thanks a lot for taking us on your journey from anthropology studies to your clay process.
Thank you.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.